Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about pointers in C, and we started talking about libraries and just generally building C programs. And one thing you're concerned with was libraries, these sort of these collections of functions. We have the kind of example of the system library, the one that contains like printf and everything in the quote-unquote standard library. And we could just have these as a bunch of .o files sitting around that we link into our application when we're generating it. But we have these better ways of packaging it, which we saw on Linux, have our extensions of .a and .so. The .a represented what we called a static library. This is one where when we link it into our program, it ends up in the executable itself. And the kind of advantage of this approach is that, well, everything's in the executable. It's kind of just like a shorthand for if we had all those .o files and put them in. And in fact, the implementation is we basically have an archive, something like a zip file, of the .o files, and the compiler includes them. And we saw we had .so files, which didn't work that way. What they did is they're shared or dynamic libraries. You'll see both terms used. And for these, we don't actually put the code in the program itself. And this has the big advantage that if we have 1,000 executables that all use printf, we don't need to have 1,000 copies of printf's machine code lying around. We can have just one, and it's going to be loaded when any of those programs starts. We're going to load it from a different file, this .so file. And that means if we have a bug in printf, we can fix it by editing the .so file. We don't have to edit all of the 1,000 executables. And this is, in fact, kind of the default for like the standard library and most other libraries you're likely to use that are kind of installed by your system administrator. Usually they end up being .so files, though they don't have to. We saw with both of these, the way we actually link them is we provided an option to the compiler when making our executable, indicating the path to look for libraries. And then we provided this lowercase l and name, and this looked for libname.a and libname.so, and would include that or the code to load it, depending on whether it's static or dynamic, in our executable. We also learned that dynamic libraries, we had this sort of separate sort of compile, I guess I should say, link time, sort of build executable time path and runtime path. So that when we said where the library was, when we were making the executable, that isn't the same setting that determines where is the library looked for when we actually run the executable. We have to set that separately. And this has some advantages, namely that, you know, I can have my, you know, developer's machine environment have the libraries in one place and know they're going to be installed somewhere else. And I can make that work more easily with this approach. That's why Linux has it, but it has the disadvantage that you can make an executable and then it doesn't run unless you do some extra steps. And then we started talking about makefiles, and we learned about kind of the key thing makefiles do, which is automate updating files. And the way they do that is with these rules, where we say, how do I update a file? And our rules specify a file, which we call the target, and its dependencies or prerequisites, the things we need to update it, along with the command to run to update the file. And our example was like if we want to make a .o file from a .c file and some .h files, The O file would be the target, the C and H files would be the dependencies, and the command would be running our compiler, probably with the -c option, to make a .o file. Questions about these things we covered last time? So in that case, let's go back to our makefile. And we finished up last time, we had briefly mentioned that the reason we had these individual rules is that we could have multiple of them and they could sort of form chains. And we have an example of that here, where I have rules for W, X, and Y, and some of them depend on each other. Some of them are prerequisites for each other. And so I have this makefile here with three different rules, and here's what my files look like. And make, to determine whether to run a rule or not, it's gonna look at the modification types and whether the file's there at all. So my question is, what commands will make W run? Just give you a couple minutes to work at this. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what you think the answer should be. Both what commands it will run and also the order, since we're specifying the order. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the answer is A, won't run any commands? W's already all set. Okay, who thinks the answer is B, we're gonna just run build Y? Okay, how about C, build W, then we'll run build Y? Okay, how about D, same idea, but we want to run build Y and then build W. A few people. But E, we're gonna run build X, then we're gonna run build Y, then build W. Okay, bunch. F, we're gonna run build X and then build W. Helpful. And something else that I neglected to put the answer. Okay, so our plurality answer is E, which is the answer I get. I'm gonna go through how I got that quickly. And to visualize this, I find it helpful to draw this graph of sort of how the files depend on each other. How did I produce this? I just read the rules. I just said W colon X, Y. So W needs to have an arrow to X and Y. Y colon X, Z. So Y needs to have an arrow to X and Z, and so on. And what we're going to do is we want to make W, and to make W, the first step is going to be to look at that list of dependencies and make sure each of those are up to date. Before we even check, is W newer than them? We don't do that yet. We first check, is X okay and is Y okay? So first, I can check X. So I look at X and I realize X depends on Q. So I need to figure out, is X out of date? And the question is X out of date is X older than the thing, any of the things it depends on? And the answer is yes. X is 3 hours old, Q is only 2 hours old, so X has some things that don't reflect what's in Q now, right? Q was updated and X wasn't updated to correspond to that yet, so we have to update X. So that means I need to run the build X command as my first step. Then I keep going. So now X is up to date. And so I'm going to update my chart and say X was just updated. You know, it's no longer 3 hours old. And I'm going to check the next dependency of Y, which is to build Y, I need X up to date. Well, fortunately, we just updated it. It's all set. Nothing to do there. I need Z up to date. That is perfectly fine. Z doesn't have any dependencies. It's there. There's nothing to run for it. And then I need to check, is Y, you know, less recent than X or Z? And the answer for both, we're going to say yes. We're going to consider something that doesn't exist as infinitely out of date. So we have to build Y too. And then we're going to look at, finally, is W actually up to date? We've checked whether W's dependencies are up to date and fixed that problem. And now, only after doing that do we get to ask the question, is W itself up to date? And here we find out that, well, W's only 1 minute old, but that's not good enough. It's not good enough because X and Y were just updated, they are more recent, therefore we have to update W too. So questions, how I did this analysis? So if X is already up to date, so for example, you mean like if X wasn't 3 hours old, but it was like 1 hour old, yes, then we would not need to build X again. I guess there's like two things I want to get across. One is that it's always the relative comparison, so can't look at the absolute time. In our example, you know, X and Q were both pretty old, that wasn't the check. It was how are they relative to each other, and we take into account the updates we just did when figuring out what to run. Okay, so we've seen our normal makefile rules for making files, and if you look at real makefiles, we'll commonly have rules with targets that aren't real files. So for example, it's very common to make it so we can type make all to build a whole bunch of things. If I have a kind of project that has a bunch of different programs and libraries in it, you know, we'll have one makefile maybe for all of them, and I'd really like to not type make program one, make program two. I can just type make all to build all the programs and libraries that are included in this project. And to enable that, we'll create a rule where the target is called all. That's just so I have something to type in the command line, and it depends on all the things we want built. And that's just going to basically be a shorthand for typing make program one, make program two, then make libfoo.a in this case. And that works because we learned that the first step in evaluating the rule all is make sure all the dependencies are up to date. The dependencies of all are up to date. And sometimes we'll have targets that don't actually build a file. So for example, it's very common for a makefile to have a clean target that removes sort of temporary files that were created during the build process. So in this example, my clean target removes main.o and extra.o that are files that we don't really need to keep around. We can recreate them if we want to. And I'm passing the force option to rm so it doesn't complain if main.o doesn't already exist. And this seems like kind of a hack. So if we think of what happens when I type make clean, so make is going to look at the rule for clean. It's first going to check all its dependencies. There are no dependencies. That's a really fast check. They're all up to date. Then it's going to check, is clean, you know, out of date relative to the dependencies? And clean probably doesn't exist, so it's infinitely old, so it's out of date. So we have to run the command. But I have a question. So what happens if I actually have a file named all or clean? What's going to happen? Is this trick, so we're using this trick to just have a target be a shorthand, but we're kind of assuming the file doesn't really exist. What happens if the file actually ends up existing? Yeah? The shorthand would override, what do you mean override the removal? So you're saying for our first question that if I create a file called all, it won't actually compile things? So that isn't true, but the reason why is subtle. So here, I want to make an observation that the result of this is the same no matter what modification time W has. So the dependencies of all actually will always be compiled. That is not a problem. Yeah, question there?
So I was going to say that probably still works. It's just running a command based on a keyword.
So what do you mean it? Make all probably still works? Or I have two questions here.
I think make all would still work.
Okay. You think make all would still work? How about make clean?
That should also still work.
Should also still work. Okay, someone back there? When it makes C clean as up to date, yeah. So make clean wouldn't work. So make all is fine because the way make works is it looks at the dependencies and runs them first. That's always the first step. And that's what the all rule is for, right? Our all rule here doesn't have any commands to run. We don't actually care what make thinks about the all file being up to date or not, because there's no commands to run for it. It's not going to do anything, no matter whether it thinks all is out of date or not out of date. But with clean, the only reason this would work is that the clean file has to not exist, so it needs to run this rm command to create the clean file. And make's just going to blindly run that command, assuming it's going to make a file called clean, and it's going to discover that it doesn't. And it's not going to complain about it, it just ran the command like you told it to. But this is kind of not nice, so there's a solution to make this kind of shorthand work better. And that's this kind of special syntax where you can specify this sort of pseudo rule called .phony, which tells make, hey, this clean thing, that's not really a file. Just a shorthand. Please don't look for a file named clean. And in this case, the same thing with all. We're just telling it, there's no real file called all or clean. This is just a shorthand for me to type things on the command line. Questions about this phony rule target idea? Yeah.
So what would happen if there was a file called clean overall?
Question, what happens if there was a file called clean overall? My understanding is make will ignore that file in determining how to run the rules all in clean if with this dot phony specified. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? And if you look at sort of real C programs, it's very common to have a whole bunch of these sort of targets meant for running from the command line. So we saw all. Also, usually that will be the default target. And we mentioned when we talked about make files to begin with that if you just type make, what does that run? It runs the first rule. So typically we'll have all be the first rule, so we can just type make, no other things, and it builds, quote unquote, everything. You also commonly see a target called install to install the program, to maybe a test target, and you'll probably see a whole bunch of others if you have a mature C project. Okay, so we have a way to make working make files. We have this nice shorthand for running common commands that we can use make for. Let's talk about writing make files more efficiently. So here I have a makefile, and I might want to make some changes. So for example here, you know, I'm running Clang with wall, and I have some memory bog, and you know, I may have remembered from CS01, which I think at least sometimes covers this, that oh, there's this debugger for memory bugs called address sanitizer. If I just enable it with the F sanitize equals address option. But to do that, it looks like I need to edit here, and here, and here to add that. That's kind of tedious, and this is only a two-file project. It would get really tedious if I had like 15. Or, you know, maybe I decide instead of using Clang, I want to use GCC. Again, I have a whole bunch of places to edit. So makefiles have a way of avoiding this kind of repetition, known as variables or macros. You'll see both terms, even though they kind of mean different things. And so the idea is I can set these variables usually at the top of my makefile, not necessarily, and then I can use them later on. So here I make CC, a shorthand for GCC, and I use this dollar parentheses syntax to reference that in a command rather than retyping GCC every time. It also means if I want to change from GCC to Clang, I just edit that first line and it changes it everywhere. And I happen to be choosing variable names that are all in caps, in fact, very specific ones, but it's more flexible than that. They don't have to be all capitals and so on. But usually you'll see variable names like these. In fact, these specific ones, which we'll talk about later. So questions about variables / macros? Okay, so I have this variable CC for the compiler, C flags, LD flags, LD libs. And these are conventional names. So pretty much everywhere people use CC for the C compiler, they use CFlags for the options to the C compiler, you know, for .o files, they use LD flags for the options to the C compiler or linker when producing executables or libraries, and they use libs or LD libs, or you might see some other variants for the names of libraries to add when making an executable. So like RCC, this would be like GCC Clang. This would have like WAL and things like that. This is where we put the dash L path option would be in LD flags. Libs or LD libs would be conventionally where we push the dash L lowercase l name option. Questions about these conventional names? Okay, so I got rid of some redundancy, but you might still be kind of annoyed because I'm typing a bunch of stuff twice, and we better hope that when I'm doing all my copying and pasting that I don't mess it up and those match. They don't match. Make just runs the commands you specify. It doesn't, and checks the files you specify. It doesn't like check if they're consistent. All it does is copy the command, put it in the terminal, and run it, basically. It doesn't care whether it works or not. This is sometimes good because this means you can use make to run whatever compiler or whatever you want. But it means that if you make it not match, not gonna matter. So one idea we have is that we have these special variables called automatic variables, some of which are set for rules based on the target or dependency of the rules. And I have three I'm showing here that are probably the most useful. We have $@, which is an alias for the target. So here, this is going to become program because we're in the rule for program. And here, it's going to become extra.o because we're in the rule for extra.o, and so on. There's another one of these for the first dependency. So here, the first dependency is extra.c, and here it's main.c. And there's another one, $, whatever the actual name for the XOR symbol is, and this represents sort of all dependencies. So in this case, that is this main.o, extra.o. And this is just a text substitution that make does before running the commands. So questions? These automatic variables. And yeah, these automatic variables have kind of unpretty names. Presumably, the idea when they were coming up with it is that these names would never interfere with variables you define and that they're fast to type. Are they? Is this in retrospect a good design? Probably not. But again, make has been around for a long time, for better or worse. Question. Okay, and one brief aside here, since it comes up on this slide, that you know this only works in certain versions of make, some other things. So there are multiple implementations of make. Oh my. Where did my center? Where did my, oh, I know what I probably did, no. Okay. Well, as I said, there are multiple versions. There are multiple versions of make. There we go. Right there. And not sure how I did that. There are multiple versions of make. Basically, there's like the original Unix version of make, and they're kind of, there's a couple major forks of that. On Linux, the one you'll use and the one we're talking about is GNU make, but there's some other versions of make you might find that support a different set of features. And among these features is, whether this automatic variable exists or not, whether there's any way of specifying all the dependencies. And also our next topic, which is pattern rules. So the functionality I'm going to show you with pattern rules is supported by all versions of make, but there's an older way of supporting it called suffix rules I'm not going to show you because I think it's a lot less intuitive that is supported by all versions of make. So I'm going to show you the GNU make version, which works on any Linux system, and usually you can install that version of make if you really want to on systems that don't come with it. But something I have to mention, because you might find a system, probably OS X is maybe most likely, where the default make is not GNU make. So pattern rule is a way to save even more repetition. So we have this problem here that I'm typing this command over and over again, and I'd really like a way of specifying, well, .o files are made from .c files by running a command with that pattern, and I can just do that here. So I have this placeholder of a percent sign for the sort of stem of the file name, the base part. I just say every .o file is made from a corresponding .c file by running this command after substituting all the variables. After handling changing C flags and $@ and so on to what they represent. And you might say, wait a moment, you need to specify the .h files. I can still do that, and basically make's going to merge these two rules together, so we can have kind of our rule with the command and sort of the extra rule. Make will just combine them together to make the overall rule for each of these two targets. So this lets us avoid a lot of boilerplate in our make file and just only write things once. Questions about this pattern rule? Yeah.
Can you explain what you mean by like it
merges
the commands?
Can I explain what I mean by it merges the commands? So basically it kind of turns this into a combined rule that includes this command and this dependency and these dependencies all together. As if you had typed sort of the rule that combines all those rules together, that would have made sense. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Yeah.
Why are you respecifying extra .c?
Why am I respecifying extra .c? I'm not sure if that's strictly necessary, but for me, I actually don't know offhand if whether or not you need to put the .c there. I would need to check. Other questions? Okay, and it gets better than this. It turns out that this rule is very common, and I told you CC and C flags are conventional names for the compiler you're using and the options to use when making .o files. And because of that, make actually has the rule built in. So you don't even need to type it. It's already there. So I can just say, it depends on .o files. Here's how you make the program. Here's how the .o files depend on .c and .h files. And make knows how to make .o files from .c files already. It just has that rule hard-coded as a default that I just showed you, that pattern rule. And it has that for its number of other languages. So we have an upcoming lab this week. And in that lab, you're not allowed to use built-in rules. We want you to know how to write rules when it comes up. You know, sometimes you won't be using a language your compiler make knows about, so you should know how to write rules, but I want you to know, in the real world, you might not need to write it. It's just already there. Assuming you're using a language, you know, that make understands. Questions? Built in. Okay, so some last things about make. So one thing you might notice is that it's really annoying to write make files. We saved a lot of the annoyance by having these built-in rules, by having these variables to avoid repeating ourselves. But it still seems really error-prone, especially for C files and their .h dependencies, right? I could easily forget one or get them wrong. So there's some ways that you'll see in a typical large C project of automating that and making that a lot less error-prone and a lot less work. And one way this works is that Clang and GCC and most C compilers have some sort of option to output dependency information. In the case of Clang and GCC, probably the easiest is the dash M, capital M, capital M option, actually outputs a make rule. It outputs that extra.o colon extra.c extra.h line for you. And the compiler figures that out by, you know, running it through the preprocessor and looking at all the includes. And you might see some larger C projects have some way of like automating running this command and using it in the make, adding it to the make file automatically. So there's not even like manually running it and copying it. Another thing you'll frequently see is make file generators. So some people won't write a make file by hand, they'll instead use some sort of program that writes a make file and then use that make file. Some questions. Automation for writing make files. And so I showed you make files, and there's other things you might see used in practice. And we're teaching make files here because, well, they're kind of the classic, the original build system. But they're definitely not the only one used, and there's a lot more recent build systems and lots of controversy about which one is best or worst. But kind of the fundamentals of how they work is the same as make, right? They have some way of specifying these rules that are based on dependencies. They have some of the important rules are built in. So they'll handle things in common languages for you, so you don't have to specify them manually like we're learning to do. And just, you know, so when those situations come up, you can do that. But there's other build systems out there that, you know, are basically like, you know, doing the same thing make does. Maybe they have more features, maybe they're easier to use. So like Ninja, Scons, Bazel, Maven, Xcode, and VS Code's build system is basically something has the same functionality but implemented with a different sort of make file syntax and so on. There's also a bunch of makefile generating tools, or often they'll generate a makefile or a file for one of these other make-like build systems. So CMake is that way, for example. So CMake auto tools, QMake are tools that generate makefiles or generate inputs for other make-like systems. So questions about build systems generally before we move on to our next topic. Yeah? What do you mean make-like systems? In that, like make, they have some sort of internal notion of rules where they look at a target and its dependencies, compare when they were modified to decide what to do. As opposed to these make file generators, which don't implement that functionality themselves, they just implement an input for a system that does that sort of dependency checking. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So let's talk about, our next topic is permission. So let's say I'm opening this file here. So the way I do that in sort of Unix is there's a call called open. It asks to open a file. There's some other ways of opening a file. And I'm asking to open this, C user C rise private.txt, which is a file and portal that, should be private. And what's this function call is going to do is it's going to make a request to the OS. And on Linux, this is done via a mechanism called a system call. We'll talk a little more about what system calls are later, but the system call is going to make a request to the part of the OS that's always running, known as the kernel. So the kernel is the part of the OS that's always running. And the system call sort of makes a request to the kernel. And the kernel is going to be the part of the OS that actually has the ability to access the data for this file. And it needs to decide, is this operation allowed or not? And if it doesn't allow it, that it's not going to happen. So the system call instruction, basically so the system call operation is a special instruction that moves the processor into a privileged mode. So we'll talk more in detail in the next lecture about sort of what the actual mechanics of like using this instruction are. But the key idea for our purposes today is that when we run this special system call operation, this core part of the OS, we call the kernel, runs in this privileged mode and gets to decide what operation to do. And it decides if it's allowed to proceed. And it's the only way we can access sort of special hardware functionality like actually talking to the hard drive to read the contents of a file. The program is never going to do that directly. It's always going to go through this kernel. And that's why, we're going to have this decision it needs to make about, okay, I'm running this, there's this request from a program. What do I do? Do I allow it or do I not allow it? And if you don't allow it, well, the program can't do this operation because the only way to do it is to have the hardware in the privileged mode where the operation is possible. So if you don't allow it, you're just going to go back to the unprivileged mode. The program's not going to be able to do opening the file. So a question is, we have the OS handler that runs for the system call that needs to decide what to do about it. And if we think of the system call, we're learning that we have this request, which is going to be open. Only, if that's our request, this is not enough information to figure out yes or no. It's not there. So where is that information? So we're going to need some extra data to actually know, do I allow this open request or not? So we could think, okay, let's add an argument, right? Do I allow it? So let's make the request. Instead of it being open, the file ucrice-private.txt read-only, why don't we just add an argument to there, right? We could add an argument saying allowed, right? That's not an acceptable solution because the program is making the request and it can change that request. That's just being made by assembly instructions. You can write assembly instructions that put whatever you want in these arguments. So another idea you might have is that we could look at the return address. Right, system call, we're going to learn, is kind of like a function call. There's a return address. We could look at where the return address is. But there's a problem there too, that if the return address, let's say it's Vim, you know, someplace in the Vim binary, well, maybe that's okay if I'm running Vim. It's not okay if you're running Vim. So that isn't enough information either. So we're going to need some extra data, you know. So we can't use the system call arguments because these can be forged, you know, by custom assembly. There's nothing protecting them. We can't use this because, you know, matters, you know, the same program can be run by two different people. So we're going to need to have some extra information that we track. And what we're going to do is for every process that's an instance of a running program, we're going to track what we'll call a user ID. So we're going to have some procedure that sets the user ID for every single process. And this is going to be tracked by the kernel, that core part of the OS, in a way that can't be directly manipulated by normal programs. And we're going to read that information when we make the decision, is this open request okay or not? We're going to use the user ID to make that decision. So on POSIX systems like Linux, our user ID, well, it turns out we have multiple of them, but the most important one is what we'll call the effective user ID. We'll talk about why are there more than one user ID for a process later. But the most important user ID is this effective user ID. And you can get the value of the effective user ID with the standard library function get EUID. And it's going to return a UIDT, which is a number. And that number is what the kernel knows about. What the core part of the OS knows about is just that number. You probably don't use a number to log into the machine. You probably use a username. And you might say, what's going on there? Well, there's this mapping that's maintained by the standard libraries and programs on the system that turns those user IDs into names that are human readable, but that's done entirely outside the kernel. The kernel doesn't track that stuff, but like WinLS or the login program is dealing with your username, it's going to look up in this mapping how to convert it into an ID and vice versa. And specifically, usually on a single user system, that mapping is conventionally stored in etc password, which used to contain encrypted passwords. It no longer does, but it still contains all the usernames and user IDs. On something like the department machines, well, we need to have this be the same across every single machine. So there's a network database that all the department servers have access to that they over the network that has this ID to username mapping. Okay, so questions about the effective user ID. So this effective user ID is all we really need, but it's going to be convenient to actually have even more information to check permissions. And we're going to have specifically something we'll call groups. And like users have IDs, groups are also going to have IDs. And each process is going to be associated with several group IDs. And we're going to have an effective group ID. And also, we're going to have this list of extra group IDs. And kind of the history here is that Originally, they said, oh, people only need to be in one, only need to have one group. Then we realized that's not very flexible, so they added these other ones, but it's kind of tacked on, and that's why they're separate. If we were designing this from scratch, probably there'd only be the get groups function and there'd be no EGID thing. And like the user IDs, this is going to be tracked for every process by the kernel. And like with user IDs, there are actually some extra group IDs we're not mentioning yet. And so what IDs like, and I can run a command. So in this case, I ran the ID command on a very old machine called power4, and I have this list of IDs. This command just queries what are my current group and user IDs. So we can see that the effective user ID is 85812 or 182. My effective group ID is 21. And get groups return 21, 325, and 90027. Those were kind of the return values of those library calls. But those numbers wouldn't be very useful. So the ID program also looked up in that database sort of what the user ID and group IDs corresponded to as names. It's outputting those, that correspondence, so I can figure out what's going on. So questions, these user and group IDs. Yeah?
What are those underlying 325?
What is what?
The group equals 21, 325.
What are the groups 21, 325, and?
Yeah.
So we know that the names are CS faculty instructors and CS4414, so we can. So based on that, I might guess that these groups are used to identify processes running by people who are CS faculty or instructors or somehow associated with CS4414. As for, is that actually true? The question is, did the system administrator actually set it up that way? Does that answer your question? Yeah. Why doesn't the kernel know about the database? So I guess one thing is that this is a, you know, it doesn't need to implement the functionality we're going to talk about. I guess it's just simpler not to handle strings in the kernel is probably the motivation for doing that. You could absolutely, there probably are kernels which do know about the mapping, but Unix, and I think a lot of OSs don't do that just because it keeps things simpler as far as implementing that kernel. Other questions? Yeah, back there.
Is it a security
risk to be able to access these IDs publicly? Is it a security risk to access these IDs publicly? No, because in order to change the IDs with my process, I need to change stuff that's managed by the kernel. Like, I can read this data, that's fine, it's just, you know, as long as I can't confuse the kernel about what my IDs are, it's not a problem. Yeah? 325 is the group, is the, yes, group ID, is group ID 325 is on my get groups list. So basically the ID command called this function, and 325 was in list after the function returned, and it looked up what name that corresponded to, and the name was instructors. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? And from what I've shown you here, these groups kind of seem to be motivated by, oh, I have users who are all faculty or all instructors or all associated with the course. I want them to have kind of be grouped together, which we'll see why that's going to be useful. We can also have groups for other reasons. So for example, a decision I can make is I could say, well, sometimes users need access to the monitor kind of directly, so, but we don't want everyone to have access to the monitor. So what we can do is when you log into a system by, you know, stepping in front of it, we'll run your processes such that they're in this group we'll call video. When you SSH in, we won't do that. And that means your programs that you run by stepping up to the system physically can access the monitor. The ones you run by SSHing in can't. And this seems like a great idea for kind of giving you kind of limited access to the monitor sometimes, but not all the time. I would say as a, you know, this is a nice idea, but it's not as practical as it seems because of one big issue. It's that once a program starts, it still has the same group ID. And if I can log out and leave a program running in the background, it's still going to be in the video group unless we do real special work to change that. So I don't think this is actually as practical as we'd like, but that's the idea. And that's why we have this flexibility to set group IDs kind of differently for different programs. That's not just inferred from the user ID, that they actually can be set independently. So you can run a process in a group that's not normally one my processes would run in. Yeah?
Can you give like another example for, I guess, why this isn't a great solution? Because I feel like it would kind of make sense to have like a hundred of like things that run, for example, when the user logs out, you would just shut down like all the processes associated with them.
Question, couldn't be, basically your question is, isn't this not a problem if we just make sure we shut down all our users' processes when they log out? Yes. So if you want to use this solution, you just need to make sure you have that functionality. I would say that functionality is maybe less common than you would think. And I guess even more so, like, it used to be very awkward to do on most systems. I think these days on Linux, there's a way you can configure systemd to do that, but like a decade ago, it would probably be very hard. Yeah?
Can processes have multiple group IDs?
Can processes have multiple group IDs? Absolutely. And we saw that here. There's only one effective group ID, but all the group IDs matter. All the ones returned by this get groups function, these extra groups. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we talked about users and groups, and we need to go back to our open call and decide who can access open files. And POSIX, sort of standard Unix, has this notion of this way of deciding what you can access in a file, and what we'll call an access control list, meaning it's a list of, it's access control, controls who can access it, and it's a list, but it has this fairly restricted form. We can specify one user ID, and not just one user ID. We can specify a user known as the owner, and whether they can read, write, or execute the file. And this owner implicitly also can change all this information about who can read, about read, write, and executing bits. We have a group ID, one group ID, and whether that group can read, write, or execute. And we have a default setting. If someone accesses the file and they aren't the user ID and aren't the group ID, what can they do? So we have a set of 9 permission bits that can be changed by the owner. And one group ID that, it turns out, also can be changed by the owner to control access to the file. And the way I'm showing this to you, it looks like, oh, this is just for regular files. We can read, write, or execute. What happens with directories? On directories, we have this, we still have an execute bit, but it actually means search. Can you open a file in that directory if you know its name? Reading a directory means can you list it? And those are separated out in these permissions. Okay, so questions? So we're going to have these permissions here, these read, write, and execute bits. And those are conventionally encoded as a number. And we have 3 bits for 3 things. So that's a 9-bit number. And you will commonly see these numbers written in octal. That's base 8. People used to really love writing things in base 8, where today we'd probably see them written in base 16. And that was true when this was being come up with. But we still see octal base 8 used for this. So we'll write it as a 3 octet, not octet, whatever we call and rate it, 8-bit rate it, or 3-bit rate it, but 3 digits of octal. And we'll conventionally have the high order digit be the user permissions, then the group permissions, and then the other, the default permissions. And we have 3 bits. The high order bit will be the read bit, next will be the write bit, then the execute bit. So for example, 700, or in binary 111, then 000, then 000, that's read, write, execute, yes, for user, no permissions for group, no permissions for default. Or this 451 case, we can write that in binary again, 100, 101, and 001, that's user can read, group can read and execute, and others can only execute. And we can set those permissions if we're the owner of a file or a system administrator. We can use the chmod command to change these permission bits. And we can specify the octal number, or there's this alternate syntax here where we can use letters. I find the alternate syntax much more readable, but people who've been around a while are very used to the number syntax, and it used to be the only syntax supported, and it's also less the type if you care about that. Questions about this chmod command? Yeah?
Do all of these on-chain syscalls have CLIs for the same thing?
Do all the POSIX syscalls have CLIs for doing the same thing? Most of them? What?
Okay.
Over the same name? So you're remarking that it turns out the library call chmod command makes is chmod. Does that always match up? And the answer is sometimes. Happens to match up in this case. So here I'm showing setting those permission bits to some exact value. Commonly, you might use chmod to change them in some other way. So for example, I can say add read and execute permissions. And in which case, chmod will look at the current permissions, set the read and execute bits if they aren't set already, and set those permissions without changing any of the others. Or you can like remove permissions and do combinations. Questions? Okay, and so as I said, chmod, this is something you can do if you're the owner or a system administrator. If not, you try to chmod a file, it's just gonna say permission denied. You can't do it. And when I introduced this, I told you this is a very restricted access control list. And sometimes, and on some systems, parts of our department machines, you'll have access to much less restricted access control lists. And POSIX has standardized some less restricted access control lists. On Windows, NTFS, which is one of the Windows file systems, supports much more flexible access control lists too. So sometimes you'll have these more flexible access control lists. I'm going to show you the POSIX versions of these. And this is part of POSIX, but a lot of Unix systems don't support them. Some do. And our department machines sometimes support them. Depends which directory you're looking at. And the POSIX ACLs, they work the same as our restricted ones, but instead of having one user, which is only the person who owns the file, and one group, we can specify multiple users, which don't just have to be the owner of the file, and multiple groups, and specify read, write, and execute for each of them. And we can use this file syntax here. So here, I'm specifying that the students group can read and execute, the faculty group can rewrite and execute, user MST3K, regardless of what groups they're in, can rewrite and execute, and user TJ1A, regardless of whether they're in any of those groups, can do none of those things. So unlike our chmod permissions, I can specify all sorts of different groups. I can specify extra users with different permissions other than the owner. So this is much more flexible. Disadvantage is it's not supported so often. Another disadvantage is it's easier to set these and not realize you set them and have confusing things happen. It's generally a lot more flexible. So questions about this access control list idea? So I've shown you kind of the syntax for basically a configuration file. You might say, how do I actually apply this to a real file? And let's look at the command. So that on Linux, kind of the two big utilities you use for this are there's this get facl, file access control list, and that will output something that looks like this. And there's set facl, which will modify the access control list for a file. And there's kind of two main modes you'll use this in. You can modify the access control list with dash lowercase or capital M, and you can delete lines from it with dash X, lowercase X or dash capital X. The lowercase M version, you just specify in your command line the line to add or merge with the access control list. So in this case, I'm saying, oh, I want to change the permissions for TJ1A to make it so they have no access no matter, you know, what the other, you know, they have no access if you're that user. You can also have a file with a bunch of different lines and just apply them all at once. So what you might do is you might make this text file, save it as acl.txt, and then you can run this command to apply that text file to a file. And that's obviously convenient if you like have a whole bunch of users you want to give access and there's no like convenient group for them, you can just list them all and do that. And that's like where this becomes like really useful is when using a group ID is kind of not viable. You know, when you'd want to have like lots of different users listed in some way, this gives you the flexibility that the sort of standard old system with chmod doesn't. On the other hand, this is a lot more complicated for both users and the OS, and also therefore is less well supported and more work to use. Yeah, question.
What's the difference between having the user specified in the file with no permissions and just not having the
permissions? So the question is, what happened? So here, I have a user specified with no permissions. How is that different than if I just remove this? So POSIX has this rule about how it interprets access control lists, which is they aren't applied in order. Instead, we look for a user rule. And if a user rule applies, we use that. We don't look at any of the group rules. So that means that this user entry will take precedence over, will override any group rules. So if you're TJ1A, even if you're part of faculty, you won't have access. I will say not all access control lists work that way. So I don't know if like Windows does this, but this is how POSIX decided to make them work. Other questions? Yeah? Is there only one entry for each identifier? I believe that's how it's supposed to work, yes. I assume if you try to have multiple, they get merged together in some manner, or one overwrites the other. Like if you have to try to have two entries for TJ1A. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about sort of representing permissions for files, and that we have this system called this request to the OS where those permissions are checked. We read the access control list, either the very abbreviated chmod version or that like really complicated version, and verify the permissions. We also have permissions checks kind of on other operations. So for example, there's a way of terminating programs. And generally, if we're in Portal, we don't want you to be able to terminate other people's programs, even by accident. So there's an authorization check there, but programs don't have an access control list. You can't chmod a process, chmod the file executable, but that's not the process. Like, so instead, what the OS checks is that the user ID you're killing with, you know, terminating the program with, matches the program's user ID. And there's other checks you might have. Now, this is for normal users, but often we want the system administrator to be able to do extra stuff, like set up new users, change what users are the owner of a file, things like that. And we want to have some way of having extra access for that. And on Unix systems, we have a special user ID, which is user ID 0, that is special in that respect. It's just hard-coded in the OS that user ID 0 has extra access. And basically what happens is that if we think of our open implementation in the kernel, for example, it's going to say if the user ID is 0, else, check permissions. Check the ACL. So it will just skip the permissions check for user ID 0. For both like opening files and a whole bunch of other operations. And we call this user ID super user or root. Most non-Unix systems have some sort of equivalent of this, which might have different names. So on Windows, you might have administrator or system. Same concept, the special user ID that has extra privileges and basically skips essentially all checks for are you allowed to do something when they make a request of the OS. In addition to like opening files without worrying about the access control list, this user ID 0 also can do some operations that are kind of system administrator like and dangerous, like shutting down the system or mounting a new disk, adding a new disk to the system basically. Those will be restricted to user ID 0 typically. So a common point of confusion is that people say, okay, user ID 0 bypasses all the permission checks. And when I told you about system calls, I said, oh, the system call implementation, the implementation of open, runs in this privilege mode that we'll learn is called kernel mode that has extra access to the hardware. So doesn't that mean if I'm running a super user, it's like I'm in kernel mode? And the answer is no. So our processor has two modes, this normal mode, user mode, where some operations, like accessing a disk, are restricted, and this kernel mode, where they aren't. And the OS gets to run some of its code in kernel mode. Like the thing that implements open, that's going to be written in kernel mode, because otherwise you can't access the disk. But the programs that are running a super user still run in user mode. All that changes is that when they make a request to the OS, and the OS runs the sort of code that responds to that request in kernel mode, that code has that different if statement. It says, if UID equals 0, okay, we're set, rather than checking the access control list or similar checks like that. But the code still runs the same way it would for you or I, not as a system administrator. The only difference is how the OS responds to requests from the code is different. And a way we can kind of think of this is that this kernel mode is a way for the hardware to represent you have extra access when you make a request to the hardware. So normally, if I'm writing assembly and running it as a normal user on, say, Portal, and I try to directly access the hard drive, that's just not going to work. But the OS's code that has the same assembly is going to work because it's running in kernel mode. And kind of analogously, normally, when I ask the OS to open a file that is restricted, it's not going to work. But if I'm running a super user, it is. So super user changes how the OS responds to requests, just like kernel mode changes how the hardware responds to requests. Okay, so this is where we'll finish up this time. Next time we'll talk about what about things like logging in and things like that? How is that going to work?